metaphors to indicate that the living entity is tiny. Quantitatively, very small. Qualitatively, the same.
Gold. And a piece of gold and a gold ring, Prabhupada would say, gold ring and the gold mine. They're the same. Gold is gold. And it's not that there's Indian gold and American gold or Russian gold, or it's gold, or Hindu gold and Christian gold and Muslim gold. It's gold. The designation is inappropriate. The designation of the covering of the gold. So when the gold is, whatever the right term is, purified, so it's not, the alloys are removed, the essence of gold is gold. And the essence of gold is like that of the gold mine. So we have qualities like the Supreme, but very tiny. So, whatever you can think of that are the qualities of the Supreme, He has form, we have form. He has intelligence, we have intelligence. He has strength, we have strength. Tiny. He has free will, unlimited free will. What does that mean? He just wills something and it happens. He doesn't even have to do anything more than that. He doesn't have to lift his pinky. He can lift Govardhan Hill without lifting Govardhan Hill. He can do anything effortlessly because his potencies carry out those things, and his potencies are unlimited as he is unlimited. So as he has unlimited free will, we also have free will because we're part and parcel of the Supreme. So our free will is tiny. His free will is unlimited. And what is free will? This one of the many things that are very tiny that we possess like Krishna possesses. The Sanskrit word is Icha. Icha. Icha dvesa samutena dvandva mohena bharata. The verse in Bhagavad Gita that says, living entity overcome by the desire of, overcome by the dualities of raga and dvesha, falls into the material pool. Raga is, in this case, it's, music is also raga, but there's another meaning of raga is like coveting, desire. We desire what? We desire enjoyment independent from Krishna. So I'm going to refer to Bhakti Sandarbha. Bhakti Sandarbha is a commentary, is one of the six-part commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam by Jiva Goswami. And it's a brilliant treatise on whatever you want to know that's in Srimad Bhagavatam, according to categories of topics. And in Bhakti Sandarbha, the subject is, of course, Bhakti. And towards the beginning of Bhakti Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami asks a question, which is, how does one's involvement in the material existence begin? With the reasoning that if you understand how your involvement with material existence begins, you can understand how to get out. Very logical. What door did we come through? That tells you how you can get out. Very logical. Of course, there's another door, but... And then he poses, some say this, and he, disproves it. Some say that, and he disproves it. Some say so many things, and he disproves it. And then he accepts that the scripture says, he uses the phrase Bahir Mukha Jeev. One turns one's face away from the Supreme. One turns away from the Supreme. Prabhupada made it very simple. He said, when you look at the sun, all you see is light. When you turn your back to the sun, all you see is shadow. Of course, you see what's around the shadow, but you don't see light, you see shadow. And we're in the shadow position. Bahir Mukhaji. We turned our face or our attention away from the Supreme. So, what's the solution? Turn your attention again to the Supreme. Just do a 180. And there you are. However, it's not just as easy as doing a 180. Isn't it? Yes, Maharaj. I'll tell you a little anecdotal. Maybe you've heard this before, but it fits. Nice story. I was once visiting somewhere, remote somewhere, and a family, it was a new family, and they were really enthusiastic to host a program. And they wanted me to present something really introductory because it was going to be their friends. You know, that like hadn't any association with devotees, so like not even just Krishna Consciousness 101, just like really beginning. So I said, okay, and how many people are coming? Oh, 30 families are coming. And I said, it doesn't work like that. Oh yes, they all said they would come. I said, here's the rule of thumb. New people, of those that commit, that say yes, I'll come, half of them will come. No, they'll all come. Okay. Half of them will come, and they'll come in time for prasadam. No, they'll all come right away because they all promised me they would come. Okay, so sure enough, the devotees that came along with me and their children. So I thought, okay, they'll come late. Some will come, like, you know, not just at prasadam time, they'll come a little bit before that. So I had the children sit in the front, and they were littler than these children. More like this one over here. Real little ones. Like you. Not to look over your shoulder. You. No. Your age. Kids your age. Okay? So they're sitting right up in front, and I said, okay, I've got a quiz question for you. Yay! But you got to put your hand up. You can't just like blurt it out. So here's the quiz question. Here's a living entity. They come into the material world thinking, I want to enjoy. And they make their plan for enjoyment. And it doesn't quite work out the way they thought it would work out. So they make some adjustments and they try to make it happiness happen that way and doesn't work out, and so they make some more adjustments and then they finish their lifetime, so they've got this desire to enjoy, so they take another lifetime and another lifetime and another lifetime, and some point the light goes on and says, hey, this program isn't working. I want to go back where I came from. I want to go back to being with Krishna. So you just do a U-turn and go back to Krishna. And when you try to do a U-turn and go back to Krishna, you find that it's not so easy. This is the free will question. It's not so easy. How come? You know, the kids raised their hand, and I called on a few of them, and they were blank. They didn't have anything to say. And they just giggled. And so then one very little girl sitting right in the front, she, after everybody made a bunch of noise, she raised her hand and she said, see if I can remember as closely as possible to what she said. She said, the soul desires to be with Krishna, but the senses want to enjoy. Wow. And then another boy picked up on that, and he said, yeah, the soul wants to be with Krishna, but the mind wants independence. I said, wow, you got the answer. Perfect. And then the parents started coming in. The guests. So there's two parts. I'll get a little technical. In Chaitanya Charitamrita, you can look it up later. I was thinking to bring it with me. There are two features of, or two dimensions or aspects of Maya. And the technical terms are Avaranatmika Shakti, and the other is Pratpekshatmika Shakti. Prabhupada calls this the throwing potency and the covering potency, like a double whammy. So the U-turn part is, I don't like it over here. It was a bad decision. I misused my free will foolishly. Here I am struggling. And the happiness isn't what I thought it would be. I bought a lemon. I thought I'd get a good used car, and it's just breaking down all the time. I want to get rid of it. But there's another. So the throwing potency is when the living entity, Bahir Mukhajiv, out of rebellion, wishes to enjoy independently. So that's the first misuse of free will. It's like the primordial misuse of free will. And then there's another whole set of free will choices that we think is our independence. But it's not. It's the modes of nature. There are varieties of choices. Once we're cast into the field of the material energy, where we can choose basically according to the modes of nature. Let's just take, for example, supposing somebody has a tendency to steal. Prabhupada writes in Nectar of Instruction, there are different grades of intelligence. One is, you just hear. It's not good to steal, so you don't steal. But maybe there's a propensity to steal, so you hear, but still the propensity is there, and then you see other people get punished for stealing, and they have to suffer for that act of stealing. So then maybe you check yourself, because I don't want to suffer like that. And the third is, you hear, you see, and you directly experience falling prey to that tendency to steal, and you suffer, and then maybe you can give it up, or at least not act on it. And fourth class is, all those things happen, you still do it. So it's like the modes of nature. There's goodness, passion, and ignorance. And goodness is good. But the question of free will and karma, even with good acts, there's bondage to those good acts. With passion, there's bondage to passion. And with ignorance, there's bondage to reaction and ignorance. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Urdvam gachanti sattva-stha, those who are situated in goodness, go upwards to the heavenly planets. Madhye tishtanti rajasa, those who are influenced and attracted to happiness and passion, they stay in this realm, the realm of fruitive activities. And adho gachanti tamasa, those who are under the influence of tamagun, they go down. And there's gradations. It's like not only three places. There's regions, and then there's gradations within those regions. Here we are in the Madhya Tishtanti Rajasa. Not that, you know, Washington, D.C. isn't a good place, but there's lots of passion. And a fair amount of ignorance too. And of course this is Virginia, it's not Washington. And you know, there's different modes of goodness, modes of passion, modes of ignorance. Yes, we know different people influenced by those modes. And so we're making choices. So if I have a tendency to steal or lie or get angry or whatever, be a bully or, you know, something, a coward or whatever it is, a tendency. I get intimidated by people when they yell at me or something. Whatever the tendency is, I can make choices. I don't have to yell back at the person that intimidates me because they yelled at me. I can make some choices. That's the second limited range. But within that limited range of choices, there's still bondage, karma. I'm just going to drill down a little bit more. And two things about free will and karma. We think the tendency of the living entity that's bound by illusion, we think we're free. Arjuna asks a very nice question in chapter 3 of Bhagavad Gita, 336. He asks Arjuna, what is it that impels one into action even against one's will? You know, you decide, I want to get up early in the morning so I want to have that nice habit, so I'll set the alarm. Alarm goes off and you go back to sleep. Or something. You know, I won't get angry when I'm provoked. Or whatever it is. It's not good for me. I know it's not good. It's not, you know, some, whatever it is that you with your intelligence, you consider very carefully and you decide, I'm going to do this or I'm not going to do that. And you do it anyways. Even if it's a bad something. Why? It looks like we don't have free will. And the answer that Krishna gives is it's due to contact with the mode of passion. Mode of passion impels passion. Passionate activity. And passionate activity has a consequence. Frustration. Because the happiness wasn't what I thought it would be. Or I got the thing, but it didn't bring the happiness it was supposed to bring, or I didn't get the thing, so I'm frustrated. Whatever the combination of possible outcomes is, it ends in frustration. And so when people are frustrated, they act out that frustration. They have different ways of acting out that frustration according to different choices. Some take, you know, indulge in alcohol or some drug or just yell at people or get a gun, shoot people, or, you know, there are different things that people do when they're frustrated. Get depressed or, you know, whatever. There's different things that people can do according to the modes of nature. We're bound by the modes of nature. So it's not so easy just to do a U-turn and reconfigure your free will. But that's necessary in order to get to the position of freedom. So that's the other part of the question. How do we utilize free will so that we're no longer bound by karma? And I wanted to read two verses and short part of the purport from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 6, which is Narada describing to Vyasadeva how he became Narada. Because Narada in his previous life, he describes, was a nobody. He was the son of a Shudrani that didn't even know who his father was. And then his mother died. But before that happened, he had the good fortune of association with great souls. Because his mother, her occupation was, she attended visitors that came to a dharmshala. Prabhupada writes an inn for his Western audience because they don't know what a dharmshala is. But where saintly people would go during the rainy season and they would stay peacefully, and she would take care of their needs. And she had a little son, so her little son took care of things, bringing their meal and washing their clothes and, you know, whatever little things people might need. And he was very gentle and really appreciated it, was attracted to them. And so naturally they became affectionate upon him, and he heard their teachings as they were discussing. They even gave him direct teachings. They gave him a process of, for a little boy, a process of meditation and a process of mantra chanting, process of dhyan yoga, how he could achieve perfection of life. And he received the remnants of their food, and he became transformed. Very important. Through association, this is how free will can be properly directed. Not just by, okay, I'm going to do it. Because it doesn't happen like that. We're bound. Here's two examples that Prabhupada gives. Someone is bound, hands and legs. Another person is bound, hands and legs. Can't free another person that's bound, hands and legs. But someone who's not bound can come and free both of them. You have to find someone who's not bound. They can unbind. Another example. Someone's at the bottom of the well. Help! Help! And what are they going to do? Unless somebody comes to the top of the well, lowers down a rope, and says, grab onto the rope. I'll pull you out. You don't even have to climb up the rope. Just hang on to the rope and I'll pull you out. Who are you? Help! Help! You can't get out of the bottom of a well without someone at the top of the well who pulls you out of the well. You're stuck. But that's how you get out of the bottom of a well. Those are two examples. Same, they're very simple examples to teach the same principle. One requires association of such persons as Narada got the association of. And then after they left, he was there to continue serving and assisting his mother, but a calamity happened. She was bitten by a poisonous snake and died when she was going one evening to gather water from the well. So there's this little boy with no mother and no father, and all he had was what the great sadhus had given him. He somehow had the light went on, and this is some arrangement of providence, and it's my means of deliverance and freedom. And off he went, traveling in all different situations of life, in the hills, in the valleys, in the cities, in the villages, and experiencing diversity because he was a little boy. Before that, not seeing anything, not worldly at all. But he wasn't attracted to any of those things, because every day, morning and evening, he would do this practice that the Bhaktivedanta personalities, the great souls, had given him. Then one fine day, not by an act of his free will, but by an act of the Supreme's free will, Lord Vishnu appeared before him. And he was very enlivened and startled and stunned, and then suddenly Lord Vishnu disappeared, as suddenly as he appeared. And he started crying. Where did you go? Then he heard his voice. He said, I appeared just to encourage you. Normally I don't appear before someone unless they have become completely purified. You haven't become completely purified, but I wanted to encourage you. Live your life the same, the rest of your life, like this. And at the end of your life, you'll come to me. So he did. And at the end of his life, it describes, he was seated, and not like lightning and thunder, but like lightning and illumination. That simultaneously his mortal coil was given up and his spiritual form ascended from that body. And he became Narada with a spiritual body. He's describing all this to Vyasadeva. I mean, there's some other things that happened. By the will of the Supreme Lord, he didn't directly go to the spiritual realm. He went, at the time, it was during the previous day of Brahma. And so there was a partial annihilation. And all the living entities entered again into the body of Mahavishnu, along with Narada. And then at the time of the next day of Brahma, he came as the son of Brahma. That's our Narada Muni, in our line of disciplic succession. And then he, with his spiritual form, there was some service for him, and he's still doing it. He doesn't take birth with a material body and die because he gets a material body. Narada has a spiritual form. So his life spans over the whole day of Brahma, which is a really long time. Here's what he says. This is text 37, canto 1, chapter 6. Vyasadeva had been instructed by Narada in this whole life story, and then Narada, as mystically as he had appeared at Vyasa's ashram, he departed. Here's what it says. Thus addressing Vyasadeva, Srila Narada Muni took leave of him, and vibrating on his Veena instrument, he left to wander at his free will. This is how to use free will in a proper way, with its karma-free. Purport. Every living being is anxious for full freedom, because that is his transcendental nature. And this freedom is obtained only through the transcendental service of the Lord. Illusioned by the external energy, everyone thinks that he is free. But actually he is bound up by the laws of nature. That's the second one. You know, first is, I want to enjoy independently of Krishna, and then we're put in the field of the material energy, and then there's the modes, guna and karma. It's the second bond of maya. A conditioned soul cannot freely move from one place to another, even on this earth. And what to speak of one planet to another? But a full-fledged free soul like Narada, always engaged in chanting the Lord's glory, is free to move not only on earth but also in any part of the universe, as well as in any part of the spiritual sky. We can just imagine the extent and unlimitedness of his freedom, which is as good as that of the Supreme Lord. There is no reason or obligation for his traveling. Like going there to achieve something, get something, control something, own something, you know, win or attain or something. And no one can stop him from his free movement. Similarly, the transcendental system of devotional service is also free. It may or may not develop in a particular person even after he undergoes all the detailed formulas. That mechanical, that devotional service isn't a vending machine. Not mechanical. Similarly, the association of the devotee is also free. One may be fortunate to have it, or one may not have it, even after thousands of endeavors. Therefore, in all spheres of devotional service, freedom is the main pivot. Without freedom, there's no execution of devotional service. The freedom surrendered to the Lord does not mean that the devotee becomes dependent in every respect. Well, let's read it again. The freedom surrendered to the Lord does not mean that the devotee becomes dependent in every respect. To surrender unto the Lord through the transparent medium of the spiritual master is to attain complete freedom of life. In other words, there's the internal potency. Because we're tiny, the Sanskrit phrase is tatastha lakshana. Tatastha means marginal. And the Sanskrit dictionary defines it this way. It's like where a river meets a riverbank. On one side is the riverbank, and the other side is the river, and then marginal is where the river meets the riverbank. So, question, where the river meets the riverbank, is it river or is it riverbank? The answer is it is neither. It's marginal. And that's us. Marginal. Because we're very tiny, we can be influenced by the spiritual potency or we can be influenced by the external potency. And that's our free will. It's tiny. And then once within this, the internal potency, there's some choices. And when the external potency, it looks like there's some choices, but it's just which mode of nature is your favorite today or at this moment. And then the forces of previous choices pushing you, like that question Arjuna was asking Krishna, or the examples that I was giving, why we wish to do something but we can't, because we're conditioned by our mind and our false sense of independence. We value our false sense of independence too much, and it's a false sense of independence. That's what Prabhupada means by this last statement. We're always dependent. But we can be dependent upon the internal potency, and like Narada, then you have complete freedom. It's mystical. It seems like a contradiction of terms. It's enigmatic. It's very puzzling. By complete surrender, you have complete freedom. What? Do that one again. By complete surrender, you have complete freedom. Now, the freedom is within the internal potency. Whatever is the will of the Supreme, that's what I will. But it's really amazing, because one who has that position, Krishna subordinates himself to the will of his devotee. You catch it? Narada make this statement to Nalakuvera and Manigriva. You're cursed to become trees in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj, and Krishna will liberate you. So Krishna was bound by rope, but he was also bound by the word of his devotee, Narada. So he pulled down the Arjuna trees and liberated Nalakuvera and Manigriva. We observed Ram Navami yesterday, yes? This is a Ram Navami stump the Swami question. That's what we call it in the sannyas circuit, stump the Swami question. It's a little off topic, not about free will, but why did Ramachandra kill Vali from behind a tree? He's the emblem of virtue. Now, he gave an explanation to Vali after Vali, like, blasted him, accused him of irreligion. Ramchandra gave a reason why it wasn't irreligion. Although he's the son of Dasarath, and as a royal family member, it's his duty to uphold Dharma. And what Vali had done according to the codes of Dharma was punishable by death. So it didn't have to be a Kshatriya fighting against another Kshatriya. It was punishing him to death. And secondly, he said that by hiding behind a tree, according to the codes of Dharma, when one is killing an animal, a wild animal or an animal, one is not against the codes of Dharma to stand behind a tree or bush. It's not adharmic. All right. But couldn't he have done it some other way? He's the Supreme Lord. There's millions of possibilities. Why that one? Because here, to, you know, so many, the impeccable Ram, people are, who aren't Tattvadarshis, use their measuring sticks and say, well, this wasn't right. Have you, you've heard that discussion probably, or questioned that question yourself. Here's what some of our acharyas have to say. Vali was given a benediction. The benediction was that he would be victorious in all battle by whoever he fought in battle. Half of their prowess in battle would go to him. So they had only half, and he had their half plus his, so he would always be victorious in battle. Always be victorious in battle. But not so in fighting with Ramchandra, because he's the personality of Godhead. So any benediction given by the demigods isn't going to stand in the face of Ramchandra. So to uphold the word of the demigods, he chose that procedure for killing Vali instead of challenging him to combat and defeating him in fair combat. He did it that way, to uphold the words of the demigods, the benediction of the demigods. As much as he pulled down the two Arjun trees in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj to uphold the word of Narada. Or he appeared as half man, half lion Nrisingadev to uphold the benediction of Lord Brahma, etc. The personality of Godhead takes a subordinate position to his own devotee. It's mysterious in one sense, but it's love in another sense. It's the nature of the Supreme Lord. If we have the association of Tattvadarshis, we can understand those things that otherwise we can't understand. And if you don't have the association of Tattvadarshis, your head will spin. You'll always be looking at whatever you're looking at through the lens of your own sensibilities and, you know, whatever, speculation and your sense of what's right and wrong and what should be. I wouldn't do it that way, so why did he do it that way? Or whatever. We require, for proper knowledge, we require the association of one who has proper knowledge. Exactly what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita. Tadvidhi pranipatena pariprasnena sevaya upadikshanti te jnanam jnaninas tattvadarshinaha. The tattvadarshi can impart knowledge because he has seen the truth. And truth with a capital T. We can also read the scripture and come to wrong conclusions. Lots of people are doing it. Benjamin Franklin wrote when he was just a teenager a little epithet. My friend and I read the Bible day and night. He reads black and I read white. So reading of the scripture is important, but reading the scripture with the assistance of a Tattvadarshi, a seer of the truth. Okay, now how do you find a Tattvadarshi? This was like, was it University of Minneapolis? In University of Minnesota, excuse me, in Minneapolis. And one of the college students, PhD student, said, you go online and you'll find thousands of self-realized souls. At least they're advertising themselves that way. And how do you know out there in the spiritual marketplace what's what? So it's the same, you know, how do we know where to repose our free will in such a way is there's no karmic bondage? It's the same principle. We require someone who's not bound. We had a nice discussion on that topic. Here's it, one of the things that I shared is something that when Prabhupada was visiting in the estate of John Lennon at his request, he requested him to stay for a month. And Prabhupada stayed for less than a week because it was so uncomfortable. Not, you know, the living accommodation wasn't uncomfortable, just, you know, the mood was uncomfortable because it was a challenging mood to some degree. So there's a recorded conversation and it's also transcribed. But you listen to the record, I've listened to the recording several times, and you can pick whose voice is whose. And particularly John Lennon kept saying like 16 times, how do I know that your translation of Bhagavad Gita is best? There's so many Bhagavad Gitas out there. And everyone's saying it's the best. Same as this question of this graduate student. How do you know? Prabhupada gave different answers. The one that was I found was most outstanding. He said, Prabhupada said, so you say that you accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then he paused. The pause meant to me, I know you don't. So you accept Krishna as the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Then I ask you, whose translation would you want to read? If you find someone that is always thinking of Krishna, whatever resource they have is dedicated to Krishna's service, 24 hours a day, their whole life is simply Krishna, 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 that person is going to know Krishna. And that person can tell you the meaning of Krishna's words because they know Krishna because of that dedication, unflinching dedication unto Krishna. And it just went right past him because went on with its doubting program. So that's one criteria. There's other criteria that also can be applied. In Bhagavad Gita, there's three places. There's a lengthy description where it describes the characteristics of a self-realized soul. So I showed this graduate student, I gave him a Bhagavad Gita and showed him where he could read where Krishna describes. In any case, the how to repose free will so that we're karma free is to associate with someone who has is nicely situated in devotional service, and by dint of that, they're karma free. Their hands are no longer bound and they can unbind your bondages. The bondages are like these two children said, the senses that want to enjoy, and the sense of independence that I value too much. Like, so I don't, that means I don't really want to repose the fullness of my free will at the disposal of the Supreme. I don't want to do that. I value my independence too much. And therefore the process of devotional service is generally gradual. We do a little bit. And then we see what it feels like, and it feels good, so we do a little bit more like that. And that's fine. Incremental approach to advancing in spiritual life is wise. It's sustainable, that is, once we've gone through that careful process, then, but even that requires the association of those who are so doing. Sangat sanjayate kama. We develop the qualities like those with whom we associate. Very simple principle. It's common sense. parents are very concerned with who their children associate with, because if they're not in good association, they can become corrupted by unwholesome association, like a Jamila became corrupted. So a good person can become corrupted through unwholesome association. And it worked the other way. A corrupted person can become purified by good association. So association is very important. And being selective about association, and especially the confidential association that we keep, those with whom we intimately share our inner life and our struggles, and so we can get not just like good information, but we can get spiritual strength by that association. So here we are associating together with Krishna's message and the holy name, and one another's attraction for trying to serve Krishna nicely. That'll help us get to the point where we will use our free will properly, where it's the karma-free situation. Any comments or questions? Especially our host here, with your question.
Thank you very much. The only clarification I would request is...
Speak a little louder so they can hear.
The only clarification I would request is, even the desire to be here at this point in time, that is also influenced by the mode, three modes. So what actually triggers that? Or the other way to spin that is...
To be here mean to be in the assembly of devotees, or yes. To be here means in the material world?
To be in the association.
Okay. Well, it's... Thank you for the question. Did you hear the question in the back? Yes? Okay. I wanted to speak something about intelligence. The power of the faculty of discerning, discriminating this from that. So there's material intelligence and there's spiritual intelligence. So spiritual intelligence is something that Krishna awards, Tadami Buddhi Yogam Tam, Yenamam Upiyantite, 10:10 Bhagavad Gita, you can look it up later. Where Krishna gives intelligence to those who strive to engage in his service, he gives the intelligence how to come to him. So it's a prompt from within. As much as there's a prompt from within, from those that are exclusively involved in the material energy, like the thief. Prabhupada gives that example. From within, the super soul indicates, look out, here comes somebody. Okay, now they've gone. Now you can go and steal. It's super soul is intuitively being guided. Or another example he gives is the cat, who sits, waits till the housewife leaves the kitchen, and the cat jumps on the table and drinks the milk. So where it's super soul. All living beings are guided by super soul, without exception. So the devotee, those of us who are gathered here together, there's a prompt from super soul. This is good. Now we can be tuned into the Krishna channel or tuned into the modes of nature channel, and that's going to help determine the choices we make. And there can be a mix. In fact, Kapila Dev expresses to Devahuti, yes, there's a mix. Devotional service can be mixed with the modes of nature. It's not devotional, not that bhakti becomes mixed. Our consciousness becomes mixed. Bhakti is pure. And our consciousness, so we're here maybe for a number of different reasons. They're here because they're your friends. So they've come. Or they heard the prasadam is good. Or they'd like their children to be, exposed to other nice children. And that's like a good... So whatever the different reasons are that may be mixed with the modes and mixed with the prompt from super soul. So each one of us has the free will choice of amplifying the prompt from Supersoul to come to Krishna's shelter and to de-amplify the other ones. We can't do that on our own. We're dependent upon Krishna because he's the controller of the material energy, not us. But if we aspire like that and strive like that, Krishna can help us. So there must be, I just repeat in a simple way, there must be a super soul inspiration or an instruction coming from, same as from the inside, from outside, that says this is good. And we accept. Otherwise we'd be somewhere else. Lots of people in some other places. So there's a spiritual dimension, even there may be other influences. And there's all variety within that, you know, spectrum. So our personal cultivation, so say it again, is to amplify or tune into the Krishna channel. Like try to understand what is Krishna's message and why. Why does Krishna want this? Why is this good for me to be here? There's multiple benefits, but you know, especially what is it that Krishna wants? And so let me just read this other little purport. It's text 28 from the same chapter. Narada speaking to Vyas, he says, having been awarded a transcendental body befitting an associate of the personality of Godhead, I quit my body of the five material elements and thus all acquired fruitive results of work, karma, stopped. Purport. Informed by the personality of Godhead that he would be awarded a transcendental body befitting the Lord's association, Narada got his spiritual body as soon as he quitted his material body. The transcendental body is free from material affinity and invested with three primary transcendental qualities, namely eternality, freedom from material modes, and freedom from reactions of fruitive activities. The material body is always afflicted with the lack of these three qualities. So that's the conditioned soul before that perfect stage. A devotee's body becomes surcharged with the three transcendental qualities as soon as he's engaged in devotional service to the Lord. So there's a message that we're all hearing, and according to our aspiration for freedom, a desire for happiness, and a desire to be free from the entanglement of material existence, we then become inspired by that and try to take up devotional service wholeheartedly, as much as we can, given the circumstances of life. So there's a proportionate kind of thing. Proportionate to one's submission and surrender, one experiences freedom. And before that, there's a mix. It's not only the modes of nature that brought us here. That's not so. Modes of nature don't bring people to Krishna consciousness. Association of devotees brings one to Krishna consciousness. And being open, receptive to that. Does that answer your question? Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Maharaj, in the case of Narada Muni, there...
Can you hear him back there? Okay.
There was the direct experience that he had when the Supreme Lord appeared before him.
Unique. Not likely to happen in our life.
Yeah. And as I practice devotional service, I also get some experience by the mercy of the devotees I associate with, and also associating with Srila Prabhupada through his vani, by books or his lectures, there is some experience.
Sure.
And that
keeps us going.
Yeah, it gives an impetus to keep going. at the same time, there is a tendency to get distracted.
Yeah.
And it's sometimes becomes difficult to keep that focus and keep moving forward on that path of a devotional service.
Sure.
And because the attractions...
We're distracted.
So, in such instances, it is very difficult to keep that past experiences that I was blessed with, and I just get overwhelmed with what is
happening. So, my advice is, don't try to dwell in past experiences. Rather, dwell in the moment, which is an opportunity to surrender to Krishna. Even when distracted, it's an opportunity to surrender to Krishna. How? Understand the one impetus is you're blessed with knowledge to understand the predicament. The predicament is the ongoing residual influences of one's past involvement in the material energy. Like, you know, the blades of the fan example. When you pull the plug on the fan, the blades will continue spinning. As long as you don't plug it in again, they'll gradually stop. So when that residual distraction thing happens, you understand, I'm just not going to plug in again, and I have to tolerate. And while tolerating, I want to make an effort to invest my attention in Krishna, in Sat. And it's not happening because I'm distracted. Nonetheless, I know the principle is I have to tolerate the distraction and it's just abhyasa. Continue to strive and practice. As much as your strength and your wisdom enable you to. Another nice example given in Nectar Devotion is you understand, not just from those past experiences only, but also from so many things, from scripture and association and things. Devotion to Krishna is natural for the soul. So, like walking propensity is natural for a child. So, like a child that's learning to walk, we're like that. We get up, take a step, wobble, and fall down. And then get up and take another step or two, and then wobble and crash to the ground again. Just practice and practice, and the walking propensity that's already there, innate, it says, comes out. It's already there. So that the life of undistracted devotion is innately there. I'm suffering from distraction because of my past free will choices. I have to bear the consequence of my past free will choices. I have to tolerate it. Because I did stupid things. So here comes some, you know, responsibility for those stupid things. And who knows how long and how many and lifetimes. So I'm going to bear it, I'll tolerate it, and continue with full confidence in the reality of the soul and the reality of the soul's ability to express undistracted devotion to Krishna. According to my capacity, I'm going to keep striving, faithfully continue. Just exactly as what Lord Vishnu said to Narada. Continue like this. For your life, you'll come to me.
Thank you, Maharaj.
Yeah. Mahamantra.
Yes. Guru Maharaj, you were explaining about the free will, choices, and the modes. So, I was asked a question, in Jagannathan, like, so the person was explaining, so I am not responsible. As a soul proper for
This is a question or a statement?
He asked me that question, Maharaj. So
we're making free will choices. The free will is intrinsic to the soul. There are impelling influences that inspire us to make modes of nature choices, but we don't have to. But if we do, we're responsible. Okay? It's ultimately rests upon the soul. The soul is the seat of free will. But when we're distracted, like this expression earlier, we're it's modes of nature choices. But behind those modes of nature choices, plural, is the one choice, independent of Krishna choice. That's the root. And that's what we have to, that's the doorway in which we came into this place. And we need to correct it. And it's not as easy as doing a U-turn. Because we're distracted by the contaminating influences of our past free will choices. Misuse choices. Ultimately, simply declaring to Krishna, I am yours. Sharanagati. Krishna accepts us. Then there's the continuing to sustain and support that, like the earlier question. Yes, you had a question. Yes.
Very nice. I have a follow-up question with Raghunandan Prabhu's question.
Okay.
So there's a situation that, like, when we get deviated, sometimes we remember Krishna and then, like, we take shelter with Krishna and we say, feel the reciprocation. And sometimes, you know, we get basically taking a shelter of Maya. So it's like whatever like we are addicted to or whatever we got used to it. And there is a stage where even that Maya, whatever the association or whatever the material attachment we have, it's not even tasteful. And then, like, the same situation, we are not getting shelter of devotional service also. Like,
yeah.
So, how to overcome that situation? Like,
surrender. In that situation, you have some choices. You can just be indecisive. That's a choice too. But we can choose to take shelter of Krishna. And then comes the yeah but no, it's hard or whatever. Yeah, but so that's a choice too. This, you know, it's not that you have to be Superman and, you know, leap tall buildings at a single bound or something like that. You just overcome any obstacle because you're like Superman. You according to your capacity, you take a step toward Krishna, a doable incremental step toward Krishna in that situation that you described, caught between this and that. Consciously take one step toward Krishna. That's what you should do. And you'll know when you do that consciously, Krishna accepts your submission to Him. And though you haven't gone the whole distance, you know that Krishna is there. And Krishna has accepted your surrender, your submission, although it's, you know, modest. Minuscule even. And that gives courage and confidence, because it's just the entanglement of Maya that's keeping us away from Krishna, and it breaks the bond of the entanglement of Maya. It slackens the grip of Maya. And so it gives renewed trust and confidence and courage in the connection with Krishna program. So do that. A little incremental step toward Krishna. Prabhupada's teaching is, and it's true, when you do that, Krishna takes 100 steps towards you. He's more eager for you to be with him than you are to be with him. And you're like, and who are we? We're nobody. An insignificant one speck out of an unlimited, you know, living entities. But Krishna's loving. He'll reciprocate. And that's consoling, comforting to the soul. And then it's the same, abhyasa. Then you continue to practice that. So then, and then the time span where you just kind of hang out in that limbo situation reduces. You more quickly come to the position of a step toward Krishna. Just by exercising that free will, it's a free will choice. And keeping good association with others that share, just like you're doing, you know, their experience, when they do that, what happens? It gives you strength beyond your own strength. Yeah. Anything else? Yes.
Where they understand that we have karma, what goes around comes around, and how, you know, how karma works, but I'm really baffled in seeing how practically karma works, because when I look at the real world example, it is really tough to put the pieces together and understand it, how it is practically working. I mean, for example, let's say there is a person out in the street killing people haphazardly, or like, you know, harming other people. So if those people who are suffered because of that act, was it in their karma? And if it was in their karma, then how it came to the other person's mind to, you know, harm them? So I'm really finding it difficult to, you know, put the puzzle together to understand it.
If you were omniscient, it wouldn't be so difficult. But we're not. It's unlimitedly complex to fit the puzzle parts together. You know, cause and effect. Unlimitedly complex. But please understand the basic principle, that with that complexity, there's something behind it. Now, you may not know what's the cause that brought about the effect. So, but you read Prabhupada's books and you'll understand, you know, in a broader stroke, the complexity. The, for example, animal killing. Just take that one thing. Now, is there not going to be some reaction for that within the laws of nature? And how it plays itself out with this one and not with that one, who are we to say? You know, we're not in charge of that department of existence. There are persons, and they carry that out. But where's that person that's innocent? Just like, you know, ask another question. Where's there something that's pure? Get into it a little bit, and you know, it's perplexing. Find something that's pure. I challenge you. So, in Europe, in ISKCON Europe these days, it's a topic, I've been told, that nearly every Bhagavatam class they get into. There's nothing pure. We're compromised. As sincere devotees, we're compromised. By, you know, how do you find pure anything? Think about it. So, because the world in which we're involved is filled with contamination, with people that are doing bad things. Anyway, without all the detail. So we're implicated. And so again, the question, who's innocent? Who's not implicated? And how the whole thing, how the whole puzzle fits together, who can say? As a little boy, I used to look at the inside of golf balls. I was curious, what's inside there? Why does it make the golf ball go like that? So inside that white thing, you know what's inside? It's little thin strands of rubber bands that are wound around and around and around and around and around and around. And around, and that's what makes the ball, the golf ball go like that. So inside is so complex. So what to speak of karma? When I think of the complexity of karma, I think the inside of a golf ball. And that's simple compared to karma. Where does it begin? Where is it? And what's the cause? What's the effect? And it's too complex. In principle, there's cause and effect. So now, what are we to do with that information? I mean, supposing you were super soul. Or you had the service on behalf of super soul to mete out, you know, different individuals' karma. It's not essential for us as practicing devotees to know the detail of this is the cause that brought about that effect. I believe that's the question you're asking, isn't it? So what we need to know is the principle. And we're implicated in the contaminating atmosphere where there's crazy people running around doing crazy things. And it's just, you know, is they're generating new karma, or is the result of the person who is the recipient of their karma? Or our business is to become karma free, to lead exemplary lives according to the will of the Supreme, and make our will one with that will. That's our assignment. In the Christian language, it's let thy will be mine. Love of God. That's our assignment. Whether you understand the complexity of karma or not, you know, what causes which effects. Make our will one with the Supreme Will. And how do we know that? Through Scripture. How do we know the meaning, the proper message of Scripture? Through a Tattva Darshi. That's our assignment. To end the complexity of implication in material existence. Not just to be a good person. That's a subset of that package. It's where the will of the living entity is submitted to the will of the Supreme. Vibhishan came to Ram and said, please engage me in your service. So Griva said, I don't trust him. He's got some motive. He's been in bad association. He's been in Ravana. He's his younger brother. I don't trust him. We have to watch him. And so on and so on. So whatever the message here is, whatever one's background is, if sincerely Ram says, he hears all the ministers, they have different, everyone has something different to say. He asks Hanuman. Hanuman says, I don't see any motivation. I see his face, and from his face is the index of the mind. I don't see, maybe he wants the kingdom. He understands Ravan is sinful, and Ravan is doomed to destruction because of his sinfulness. He recognizes that you are going to defeat him. He wants to be in your service. Accept him in your service. Regardless, even if he wants the kingdom, he's got some motivation going on. He wants to be in your service. Accept him. And Ram says, it's a very famous statement from Ramayana, where Ram says, I declare it boldly, whoever even once sincerely takes shelter of me, I promise, I give my protection. So it's not like that person will never have a problem again. They don't have to pay their taxes anymore, and they can run red lights and it's okay. It's not, you know, a license for wanton life, but it's a life of responsibility or protection from the material energy through that submission to the Supreme Lord. That's our assignment. And then things that we don't understand, at least the capacity to understand is with us, and those things that we need to know, we'll know. And that's specifically how to get to Krishna. Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam upiyantite. That's what you'll receive from Krishna. The intelligence, the buddhi, how to reach him through all this complexity. That's the promise that Krishna makes and that Ram makes. I'll give them the intelligence how they can come to me. That's the protection. And then you just abide by that intelligence, the prompt from the super soul that says, yes. Instead of, well, wait a minute. I've got this other project going on. Let me finish up this other project first. Then I'll... Last question.
Related to the topic today, there was a question asked of...
Today?
Not today. Sometime ago in Bhakti
Vriksha. Bhakti Vriksha question, okay.
What's the role of Sukriti or piety in someone coming to devotional service? We often hear that, oh, I don't have Sukriti now, I cannot become a devotee. Or whenever Krishna desires, I will become a devotee.
Well, here's what Hanuman says. Of course, Ram said, regardless of these, you know, other considerations. But Hanuman says, that this is a prayer from Canto 5, chapter, I think it's 19, prayers to Lord Ram. Said, Ram doesn't consider that. Was one's past piety, one's good birth, and the fruits of past piety, good birth, we can't speak eloquently, we're not even human beings, and etc., etc. So it's not a prerequisite. He says, otherwise, how has Ram made us his friends? And it's not like, you know, hang out together kind of friends. It's transcendental commitment from Ram to them and them to Ram. It's not based on Sukriti. It's not a prerequisite nor a disqualification if one doesn't have it. It's submission. That's what Krishna says. Sarvadharmam Pritnyaja Mamikam Sharam Braja Aham Tvam Sarva Papebhyo Moksha Yashami. So whoever is saying this other just reads 1866 and there's the answer. Practically speaking, there's Vibhishan. He was in the service of the most demoniac person on the planet. Brahma immediately accepted him, cleansed. Or, you know, Prabhupada came to America with people that were so sinful. Didn't have a clue about anything transcendental. And by the process of devotional service, they became cleansed, etc. So it's not a prerequisite. I need to do some Sukriti before I can become a devotee. Or maybe in my next lifetime, I'll become a devotee. Or maybe when Krishna wants, I'll become a devotee. It's not like that. Not like that. One receives good fortune by association, and one says yes to that association and the good fortune. One becomes fortunate through the association of one who's fortunate. That's how it happens. Bhakti begins by associating with one who's carrying bhakti, not by any quantum of Sukriti. Okay. Thank you all very much. Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.